Welcome to episode 100.
Oh my God.
Of the Bay Shed podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. What's up, everybody? What is up? Obviously, this is a very special episode for me. Episode 100. Wow. All 100 episodes. Technically 99. Technically 99, because this is going to be a recap issue. You know, kind of a highlight reel. All 99 episodes have been absolutely amazing. And it's been personally rewarding and insightful, educational. It's had a lot of value to me personally on so many levels, to speak with so many great musicians and bass players from all different walks, and hearing their story and musical journeys. And for me personally, I've heard a lot of things from the guests over the couple years that the podcast has been happening that have, you know, kind of made me feel less isolated in the occupation and just studying the craft of bass playing and being a professional musician. I hope that has translated to the audience, and that maybe you folks out there have had similar takeaways from listening to the podcast. Thank you all so much for listening and supporting, and, you know, keeping this thing happen. It's something I obviously believe in. I have a lot of fun doing it. It's been a really, really fun ride. And, you know, when I started episode one with Nadav, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I'm just like, I want to start a podcast. Yeah, let's do this. This will be great. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I think I talked about it on episode one. I mean, me and Nadav were driving to a gig, and I was telling him about the podcast idea, and he's like, man, well, you know, cool, sounds good. When are you going to start it? I'm like, I don't know. What are you doing Thursday? He's like, nothing. I'm like, great, let's start it Thursday. You want to be guest one? He's like, yeah, I'm down. And that's how it started. And, you know, I remember, like, going to his place. We recorded it over at Nadav's place. And, like, I went to Sam Ash before and just, like, bought a cheap little, it's like, I don't know, $100 for 258 knockoffs, a couple stands, a bag, you know, like, super little remote setup, because the first, I don't know, maybe the first, I don't know, 15, I'd say, episodes, like, I was going to everybody's place all the time, setting up this little kind of remote rig and recording it at their spot. I didn't want them to, like, have to come somewhere, you know, or do it. And I wasn't really hip to Zoom yet. Like, that wasn't something I knew about, or Skype. Yeah. So I had this little remote rig, and I was going all over the place. And, that's how that started. So, like, getting there in the Dobbs place, like, setting up the mics, no idea. You know, I'm kind of nervous to even go back and check out that episode. Part of me wants to just out of curiosity's sake. And then the other part is, like, I don't know if I can live with whatever that is. You know, after I listen to it back, I don't know if I can live with that. Nadav was great. I remember that. I remember it being a really fun time with Nadav. And that was episode one. And since then, it has been a wonderful ride to speak to so many musicians and and learn. And there's so many people that have influenced the show over the years. Sarah at IVPR has always been very, very gracious to email me when she thinks she's got just someone who would be a good fit for the show. Another PR woman in New York, April, will send me guests. Matt Aronoff, Joshua Stamper, we're both clients of hers. Yeah, it's been wonderful. Talking and building the relationship with Dan Lakin over the years has been fantastic. Getting to meet the John and, you know, connect with him, John Diora and Chris GC from Bass Magazine. That has turned into some cool things. I am now a contributor for Bass Magazine and have my first article for the magazine coming out in January, which was an interview I recorded earlier this week with the amazing Mike Valerio. I'll have more information about that as that's coming out, and then Mike will make a separate appearance on the show. In the meantime, stop by basemagazine.com. I think that's their URL. I should really know that, huh? I should really know the nature of the people I'm plugging here. I'm going to look it up. You know, Bill Burr does this. He looks stuff up on the internet during his podcast, and I'm no Bill Burr, but I feel like I can do it, because why not? It is basemagazine.com. Check them out. Check out the articles they have up. Right now, they are talking about Roger Waters releases the Lockdown Sessions album. That's on the homepage there at Bass Magazine, so stop by and check that out. And then my interview with Mike Valerio for the magazine will be coming out in January sometime, and really looking forward to having Mike on the podcast. Like we did the podcast. Well, no, we didn't do the podcast yet. We have not done the podcast yet. The interview for the magazine, he was cutting a... If you don't know about Mike Valerio, he's principal bass, among other things, he's principal bassist on all the film scoring stuff that goes through Los Angeles. Ridiculous, ridiculous musician. And so he was cutting a session earlier that morning at Fox for a movie. And then we met at the Mexican restaurant that's close to Fox and recorded the interview there. And it was a wonderful, wonderful hang. I mean, the hang went like 3 hours or something. And so now, you know, I got to go through and sift through it. A lot of it was just like us connecting, because I had never met him. I've known of him for a long time, but never met him. So a lot of it was just us connecting, which I'll cut out for the interview in Bass Magazine. But Mike was wonderful, wonderful to speak to. And probably, you know, off the top of my head, one of the most in-demand bass players there is. I mean, he's ridiculous. He's ridiculous and crushing it. I say all that to say that partnerships that have come along through doing the podcast, like Bass Magazine, have been wonderful. My relationship with Lemur Music in San Clemente, absolutely fantastic. And the investment of Lemur into starting the nonprofit, the Bass Shed Academy, has been incredibly valuable. I was talking with the owner of Lemur the other day, and I've just been losing it, right? I've been so stressed out about starting this nonprofit thing, and I'm reading this book about like all the ins and outs of creating a nonprofit, and it's incredibly overwhelming. So I was speaking with the owner of Lemur, and she kind of talked me off the ledge. She talked me off the ledge about a lot of things. It was good. It was good. I mean, fundamentally, I believe in music giving back to society, not only through the music, but through other causes. And that's the point of the Bass Shed Academy, is that the music gives back to other causes. And so she's heavily involved with organizations for autism and music education for those with special needs. We talked a lot about that. I'm personally really interested in Music Cares through the Grammy Foundation, which is helping out people in the music or entertainment industry, you know, pay for medical bills and things like this when unfortunate circumstances occur. I've had my bout of unfortunate circumstances medically, you know, back in... I remember talking about this on the episode with Brian Ladd. Yeah, I talked about my kind of little run-in with that, having severe head trauma. Yeah, I was in a coma for the night. You know, the doctors at the hospital told my folks, you know, if he comes out of the coma, he's going to be a vegetable. Like, there wasn't a lot of hope for me left. Music Matters did not kind of get introduced during that, but I can empathize with those that fall on tragic situations and things like this when it relates to medical stuff, because I've been there. And I like the idea of music and the entertainment industry giving back to support those things. So those are causes that the Bass Shed Academy will be funding. Proceeds of the Bass Shed Academy do go to support causes like that, to give back to society and help enrich humanity, you know. And it's my small part in doing that. That's something that's really important to me. So I want to all that. That's another tangent, huh? If, for regular listeners, if you've gone through all 100 episodes of this thing, you know about the tangents, and that was one of them. My point was that I'm really honored to have connected with the folks down at Lemur, and that has been a very, very, very cool relationship. And I'm excited about where that's headed with the new things we're getting into and the Bass Shed Academy and starting the lessons program down there and all those things. For the 100th episode, yeah, I didn't know what to do. You know, I didn't really have a specific guest in mind. That's not entirely true. No, Ryan, you're wrong. I did have a couple guests in mind, and I had been really busy, still dealing, you know, with my record, doing this nonprofit thing, you know, trying to manage life and the gigs I was doing. And I didn't reach out to the guests I had in mind. That would have been important to me to celebrate the 100th episode and to have them on and kind of celebrate that 100th episode with them on it. I just didn't reach out. And that's my bad, you know? Huh? My bad. I messed it up. And so I was thinking about it, and I was talking to Christopher. I gotta talk about Christopher. I haven't talked about Christopher yet. Honestly, I don't even know if he goes by Chris or Christopher. And when he hears this, maybe he'll shoot me a text and let me know. I always refer to him as Christopher. Brilliant bass player out of Chicago that has been helping me for like maybe the last, I don't know, seven, eight episodes, helping me produce this thing. Him and I were on the phone the other day, like, man, you know, like, I dropped the ball. I didn't kind of reach out to some of these folks. Like, you know, the other idea is I've had so many great talks with so many folks, you know, leading up to episode 100. And there's still things that stick with me from almost each of the guests. And I'm like, man, I think I just kind of want to bring attention to those things, because there's still the things that these guests have said are still very much alive in my mind. And I like that. And I kind of wanted to create a little, you know, I don't want to say the best of necessarily, because these conversations that are on the podcast today, that the clips we've pulled from previous episodes, have no more value than other conversations. And these aren't the only conversations that still, you know, are very active in my mind when just looking through all the previous guests. I can remember something about each of them, and they've all made an impact on me personally. But there were some cool moments that I liked the direction the conversation went, you know, and some of them were just like really big. I'm glad I got to connect with them. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm glad I got to connect with these musicians, because they've are incredibly important to the lineage and continuum of bass playing, and all have very different approaches and come from very different backgrounds and have very different careers. So, you know, I pulled different clips from some different episodes, and you know, we're gonna hear from Lance Morrison, we're gonna hear from Jeff Braditich, we're gonna hear from Fred Thomas, we're gonna hear from Eric Rivas, we're gonna hear from David Hood, and all these people and were very important guests to me. They all have been, and it's, I mean, I racked my brain, you know, once we kind of landed on doing the episode in this kind of like, you know, let's pull clips from previous episodes. I didn't know where to start. I just sat there for like, oh man, like who? They've all been great. They've all been great. Like, I don't even know. I don't want to not acknowledge somebody else or subtly imply that this, you know, this interview was better than that interview, because I don't think that at all. I don't think that at all. They've all been fantastic. These ones were just kind of special to me. And it was really, really great to connect with these people. But I definitely want to make sure that I'm saying this, that these clips and these guests that we'll hear from on episode 100 have no more weight or less weight in the grand scheme of things than anybody else. I think it was just I like these, you know, it's that simple. I liked them. I didn't like them more than anybody else. I just liked them. And yeah, I thought this was a fun way to go about it. So that's what that is. You know, I had to acknowledge the process about who we're going to hear from and why. And it's really just because I thought it was fun. That's it. It's that simple. And they are no more or less important than anyone else that has been on the show. Lance Morrison has been on the podcast twice. He was on episode, and he was also back on the show on episode 77. Lance Morrison has recorded and performed with Rod Stewart, Alanis Morissette, The New Radicals, Leanne Rimes, Rick Springfield, Don Henley, Richard Marx, Volto, The Coors, Gavin DeGraw, like long list. Lance is a touring bass player. Right now he's on the road with Dirty Knobs, Mike Campbell's band. Mike Campbell is the guitar player, was the guitar player for the legendary Tom Petty, and Mike Campbell has a new group called the Dirty Knobs in which Lance Morrison plays bass. I originally met Lance at a dinner, at like this bass player dinner back in 2020. It was during the NAMM show. It was, who was it? It was me, Dan Lakin, Lance Morrison, John Pierce, a brilliant session player, John Pierce, Jen Condos, Sean Hurley, and was that it? I think that was it. It was a small little group of us at this like upstairs Mexican restaurant, kind of in West LA. And so that was a good hang, and that's where I met John. No, I had known John Pierce, I think, at that point. John Pierce had already been on the podcast. I met Sean Hurley for the first time. I had known of Jen Condos, and we had played with some of the same people, but she was sitting at the other end of the table, so I didn't get the chance to like hang with her that much at the bass dinner. But Lance and I were sitting right across the table from him, and I'd never met him before anything. We're sitting across the table, so we're striking up conversation. And that's where I met Lance. Was just at that bass player dinner. And yeah, and it's, Lance has become, you know, we haven't hung yet outside of the podcast, but he has been one of my favorite guests. It was wonderful to have him on the show twice. On this episode 100, we're going to hear from the first time Lance was on, episode 48. And this is a really fascinating conversation. And Lance and I, kind of, the conversation took this turn. And we started talking about healthy outlook. You know, having a healthy outlook and the perspective we have on ourselves. And how that's connected to other parts of our life, maybe our childhood, things like this. Birth order is a big one to me. I'm always fascinated by birth order and early developmental psychology, but things like that. Like those things are super interesting to me. And I loved how Lance was willing to go there. Like, we just went there, and it was a lot of fun. So here's the clip from episode 48 with Lance Morrison. You said something when we spoke, whatever day that was, Friday or Saturday.
Right.
But I liked the way you said it. And we were talking about, I think we were talking about just coming up and how we thought about ourselves and kind of the psychology of it all. But you used the phrase, a healthy outlook of your skill level.
Oh, uh-huh.
And that's a big one, I think, is people having a healthy outlook, which means, I think, believing in what you have and what you can deliver, and then don't thinking you're more than you are.
Totally.
Like, having healthy goes both ways. So it's not just someone who's maybe insecure or thinks that they're less than, but like, don't think you're the baddest dude ever, because you're not. And honestly, nobody is.
Right.
Because it's all just music, and it's different people in different places will get your thing.
Right.
So talk to me about your journey with that idea, having a healthy outlook on your playing. and your musicianship.
I still don't think I have a healthy outlook, but but it's not the I think I'm great, you know? I mean, I remember, you know, even as a kid or whatever, growing up, just, you know, just being really aware of when somebody was way too cocky and,
sure,
you know, when they were just BSing and, you know, it's like, dude, you know, this guy's acting like a total ass because he's trying to hide, you know, his lack of talent and all that kind of stuff. So I did not want to be that guy. At the same time, I'm a super perfectionist in a way, but mm-hmm. that's because I think that's the only way that people are going to like me is if I'm perfect, you know? Like if I'm not perfect, then people are going to go,
honestly, man, that sounds like some only child syndrome.
Could be. Yeah. Stuff. Dude. No. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. And I get that. Yeah. So, dude, that's how I would, like, as a kid, that's how I operated. I was like, I'm not going to speak up for myself. You know, I'm not going to say, I'm just going to stand over here and be really nice and perfect. And then people will notice me and like me and then give me what I need. You know what I mean? Like, sure.
I'm seen when I play by these rules.
Totally. Exactly.
I'm the middle child, so I'm the complete opposite. Like, I'm seen when I act out.
Oh.
when I get in trouble, that's when I'm finally noticed.
Wow. Dude, it's fascinating.
So I had to go down that, like, deep dive and even, like, try to uncover how that paralleled to my career and how that was coming out in my playing.
That's fascinating.
That's been a long, deep, you know, I've gone down that rabbit hole in my life.
But dude, that's a real thing, you know, and it's so easy to overlook it and not be aware of it. So, so, I mean, the first 10 years, 15 years maybe that I played, I mean, I was like constantly in my head, I suck. You suck. You can't do this. And like if I played a gig and, you know, somebody would come up and would go, hey, man, you sounded great. I'd be like, no, I didn't, you know, which that was like one of the first things that I realized that there was something wrong was, you know, in my 20s, probably I was like, you know what, when someone comes up and says that they loved what you did or that I played well, and I said, no, I didn't. What I'm saying is, you're full of shit, dude. You know,
right?
I'm not being self-deprecating or quote unquote honest with him and myself. I'm just totally dismissing what this person.
It communicates as dismissive. Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, so, I mean, I did learn at some point when somebody would come up and go, "Dude, you killed it tonight." To go, thank you. You know, and I'll keep my thoughts to myself. Sure. But yeah, so. So, I mean, up until this day, I swear to God, my whole operating, the way I operate is my inner voice is going, you suck. You can't do this. And then I prove to myself that I can do it, you know? So ultimately I do it, but I never learned the lesson that, you know, you don't need to just trust yourself and you'll get there, you know?
Sure. What do you feel like you're still searching for? So to use the analogy you used when you were a child, where you're just over there in the corner being perfect and getting noticed and recognized and probably praised for that, you understood what could scratch the itch. You understood that doing that gave you that payoff and you liked the payoff.
Right.
So in music, if you're still telling yourself you suck all the time, what is it that you're searching for that will give you the payoff? And do you feel like you're willing and like kind of emotionally open to receive the payoff of like, you know what, I crushed it?
So here's the thing. I think it's become such a habit, right?
Okay.
That it's hard to undo it. And dude, I do that in my normal life. I swear to God, if I'm walking through the kitchen and I bang my knee on the counter, I'm like, you suck, dude. You can't even walk.
You suck. You can't.
I'm telling you, I do that. I get.
You just have to like pace back and forth, dude, like get your walk chops together. Like
totally,
I gotta be able
exactly.
to do five.
Let me try. Okay.
And not mess up.
All right.
And
let me do this again. Totally. All right. You can do this 10 times in a row. Walk past this counter until you. Right. You know, if I drop my keys, I'm like, you can't even hold something in your hand. I mean, it's kind of, I
got to practice it like shoulders forward, shoulders back.
You know what? I've never thought of that. I never thought about practicing that stuff, but I think you're right. I need to start doing that.
Right. But that was shoes, socks, barefoot.
Oh, dude, it's so funny.
There's so many versions of this. This is, you know.
It's so funny. And I mean, I do, you know, understand how stupid I'm being at some point, but I, you know, my initial reaction is to, you know, just berate myself for being human.
Sure.
But no, dude, one of the most profound things anybody's ever told me, and by the way, I've been to therapy about my whole childhood thing. And so I'm working it and I'm trying to get better about that. But Victor Andrizo, I don't know if you know him or not, great killer drummer. And
I don't know.
Killer. He's actually Alanis's drummer right now, but he's done tons of sessions and stuff. Just great, great drummer and good guy. Two or three years ago now, I don't know how long ago it was. We were at a studio doing something and we were out back talking and I kind of went to my usual, I suck. And actually I was like, I'm not as good as I want to be. I suck. And I said, but you know what? Like that attitude has really served me because it's gotten me where I am today. You know, it's made me, you know, be disciplined. It's driven me. And so it's a good thing. And Victor said, sure. He said, dude, if you had a positive, you know, if you gave yourself a positive message, you'd be in the same place. And I was like, I mean, I almost started crying because it's true. Like, if I told myself instead of you suck, you can't do this, like, dude, you're not where you want to be, but you're going to get there. Because you're good enough and you're going to figure this out, you know, and just stay positive, I would have been the exact same player I am today.
Sure.
Without all of that negative stuff, you know?
Right. Since forming the relationship with Lemur Music has been gracious and very... generous in kind of, you know, sometimes giving me suggestions for guests on the podcasts, or, you know, here's a foundation or something we're connected to, like maybe talk to them, like, all right, yeah. I'm always interested because they're always great suggestions. And one of these suggestions was Jeff Braditich. Jeff Braditich, I know on earlier episodes, before Jeff was on, I butchered his last name a few times, and I'm so sorry, Jeff. I'm so sorry. I had to practice it. I had to practice his last name a little bit. Jeff Braditich. But yeah, so Lemur, this was part of the, you know, kind of Live at Lemur thing that's still happening, where I'll go down and even record podcast interviews at Lemur in the showroom there. But this one was a Zoom call, and I talked to Jeff via Zoom. Jeff is he's on faculty, you know, teaches upright bass at UNT, University of North Texas. A little bit about Jeff, you know, proclaimed by the New York Times as the master of his instrument, Jeff Braditich is regarded as one of the leading performers and teachers of the double bass in the United States today. Since his New York debut in Carnegie Hall in 1982, Jeff has performed more than 600 concerts on five continents, including his London debut in 1986. He has won many major solo competitions, recorded six solo albums of music for double bass and piano, and has been featured, has been featured on radio and television throughout North and South America and Europe, including CBS, CNN, BBC, and NPR. Damn, you know, like, It goes on. Like, that's just a little bit. Like, I think we can all recognize that Jeff is a badass just from that little snippet. Jeff's amazing. It's such a sweetheart. It was so great to talk to him on the podcast. He's such a sweetheart. Jeff has also authored a book called Double Bass, The Ultimate Challenge. And I got a copy of this book before Jeff was on the podcast, and I was checking it out. And then the Double Bass, The Ultimate Book, is not a book you just kind of check out It's by no means a coffee table book. It is probably the most thorough book written and assembled about every aspect of double bass, double bass performance. Every aspect. It's incredibly thought out. It's years of putting information together. And on episode 80 of the Bass Shed podcast, Jeff Bratatich, we talk about the book, obviously. Then we talk about all the micro decisions that go into bass playing. And that's why he named the book what he did, The Ultimate Challenge, is because there's so many details that go into every aspect of what we do, whether it's on the double bass or whether it's on electric bass. And I liked it. I really liked what he had to say about that. And so here's a little clip from episode 80 where we hear from Jeff Bratatich.
And I call it double bass, The Ultimate Challenge. And people laugh at that, but I ask all of my students, especially when I do master classes and the parents are there at the bass camp final concerts, I'll say, tell me one other activity in your everyday where you have to juggle so many balls that we do. Let's look at them. We've got to balance the instrument. We have to put the left hand in the right position with the curved fingers. We have to hold the bow correctly. We have to move it across string in the right place to create a sound, all based on what that little black dot on the white page is indicating to us in a totally different language, Morse code. Yeah. We have to not only do that, we have to do it at the right dynamic with the right accent. We have to do it in time and in tune with the guy standing next to us. We have to also follow the section leader. And on top of that, we have to follow the conductor. And then we put this sound out there that's supposed to be filled with some form of expression.
Yeah.
How many things? That's 20 balls right there.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything else in life that is as complicated as what we do.
I'd have to agree. And, you know, there's so many of the things you just mentioned on that list that you just take for granted. You know, you just, okay, you know, here we go. And I think, you know, the longer any of us do this, whether someone's beginning right now and in 20 years, we'll look back on their trajectory, or you've been doing it a while. There's just things you don't think about anymore. And so much of it is a blessing. And then also so much of it is a curse because you just kind of adopt this. Okay, it goes like this. Well, that means I just put it in a box if that's now how it's going to go. And I didn't create the freedom for this to go another way. Now, when you come to topics like bass setup or something like that, that's truly fixed. You know, like every time I grab my bass, it's going to be set up like that. Okay, well, that's fine. But when it comes to expression or artistry or anything, it's been something I've been working on lately now, is really mentally engaging and not taking things for granted like I realized I had been. That's something, you know, so you just kind of reciting that list of all these balls that we got to juggle while playing the instrument, it's, you know, some of them I let drop and like, well, I'm only going to juggle five now, like five is good enough, you know.
I think that is my point from a teaching standpoint, is that, okay, the student needs to learn all these different things. Where do you start?
Yeah.
And maybe they can do four or five of them already. Great. Jump to number six.
Yeah.
And is it going to be the same progression for everybody? And the answer is definitely no.
No, right?
That's why you can't say no. And we see this in our music education philosophy. It drives me nuts. It's this first, and then you can't do anything else until that's done, and then you move on to that. No, while you're learning the first thing, it's going to take a while. But if you wait until you have that perfect, you'll never get on to the second thing.
Yeah.
So it's an art.
It is. And like even a lot of time I've spent teaching myself is learning when it's okay to shift gears. You know, like I could obsess over this one thing until it is pristine. Or maybe it will never become pristine until I move on and come back to it. Okay, that's good enough. Let me put something on top of it and see how this new information shapes the old information.
Absolutely. And it's the same with studying. I find that you need to have a really strong home-based teacher who's secure enough to let you go learn from some other people, and you bring that back into that secure environment where you can then add it to what you're working on. And so it all works together.
Absolutely. Throughout the course of the podcast, there's been some guests that are like, I can't believe I'm talking to them. You know, like, I can't believe that this is happening. Fred Thomas on episode 58 is one of these guests. Fred Thomas is the bass player who played with James Brown for the longest out of any other bass player. And this actually was interesting because around the time that I did the interview with Fred Thomas, I was transcribing and kind of putting together this thing for the Bass Shed website, which was a timeline of all the bass players that had played with James Brown, and kind of, you know, I was transcribing them all and going through popular James Brown bass lines from each of the people that had tracked with James Brown, and kind of checking out, you know, maybe how stylistically they weren't all too different, but there was a there's a personality to the line that was very different based on the bass player. And so that was fascinating to me. And so around the time I talked to Fred, as I'm doing that, and I've been, you know, I was deep in the James Brown thing. Yeah, I was listening to a ton of it, researching a lot of it. And that's around the time I talked to Fred Thomas, and it was amazing to hear from this living legend of music. I mean, James Brown obviously created the genre of funk, and now I get to hear from and speak with this bass player that was responsible for performing these lines. Wow, man! Like, what a check-in! What a check-in in to music and you know, American music and American culture and all these things. Like, it held a lot of weight for me speaking with Fred Thomas, and I loved. You know, one thing I always want to know sometimes is, how'd you get the gig, right? That's what we're all doing. We're all trying to get gigs. So, you know, getting the gig with James Brown, like, how'd you get the gig? And it was wonderful hearing from Fred Thomas about how he got the gig with James Brown. And so here it is. Here's a clip from episode 58 with the living legend of funk music, Mr. Fred Thomas.
You want to hear the story?
Yeah, I'd love to.
We're coming to... Danny's coming to Smalls Paradise. He had been working up in Harlem promoting his record Sex Machine. You know, that was hot. You know, that was busting. So him and his entourage coming to Smalls Paradise this particular night. And we was playing. Maybe just four of us. You know, a rhythm section, guitar, bass, drums, and the sax.
Okay.
He came in and, you know, the crowd went ecstatic. It was crazy. Mr. Brown, sing a song. You know, they begged him up to sing a song. And he said, these band don't know my music. These guys, they can't play my music. And the people in the crowd said, yeah, they play everything, you know, like that. And he said, y'all know Sex Machine? He said, yes, sir. Yeah, of course we know Sex Machine. We always stayed up with the hot stuff, you know.
Sure.
All right. I'll see how y'all cats know it. Y'all know it. Y'all know it. We gonna want to do it. And he's went to do a little thing. Can I count it off? And I kept it, man, can I count it off? Then he hit it. 1, 2, 3, 4. Get up. We kill it, man.
Yeah.
Kill it. And right. And when he end the song with the 8 hit, we did all that. Where he just got down on the knees and hollering, during the time when Boots and them was on our way out.
Mm-hmm.
And he told his manager, Mr. Charles Bobby, he said, hide the whole band.
Oh, man.
He said, hide the whole band.
So, just like that.
And that's crazy. That's how it came about, man. And we was high, you know. From then on, you know, like, we went ahead and rehearsed for about a week with Fred Wesley, and Next thing I knew, I was in Toledo, Ohio, man, doing a big show, about 10,000 people.
How long after like that one night where he sits in on your gig till you're on the stage with him? How much time had passed?
Probably about 3 weeks.
Oh, wow. So such a quick turnaround. Yeah, you know, you're just playing a little club, and then all of a sudden it's 10,000 people. That's crazy.
You know, the thing about it, Ryan, I was nervous as a broke dick dog, man. I said, wow, man. All these people, man. And the thing about it, Brown was doing, you know, like you do a half and a half show, right?
Yeah.
I was doing 2 hours.
Oof.
Minutes, stuff like that, or 2.5 hours if he got happy. And I had a week's rehearsal. And that's, and you know, he got the breaks and the hits.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da. But I had a good memory, man. You know, that's where I learned. You know, so I remember anything, you know.
But that's great.
Whole fucking show, man, for 2 hours. You know, and he congratulated me. He said, man, you learned everything. You know, a few little things that you wasn't for sure with, you know, but you learned everything, man. He said, yeah. You know. Yeah. So that's how we got in, man. And right away with the new nucleus, man, he wanted to go into the studio.
Oh, wow, right away.
You know, after about a couple of months, he wanted to go to the studio. So we went in the studio.
And then what was that first record you cut with him?
Hot Pants.
Hot Pants. Yeah. I'm gonna pull it up. I'm gonna go down the track list right now.
Okay.
What do you remember from the session? Were you guys recorded in New York?
No, I think it was in where the hell was that? It wasn't New York though. I think it was Columbia, South Carolina. I think it was. Mm-hmm. I think so, man. So you know, a lot of years, man. Shit done passed by and went by and come back and went by. But it was Jefferson, man. You know, like he gave me a crazy line, man. You know, when you're used to just playing bass, and Brown came up with all these simple lines, man. And you got to make a simple line to make it groove. You know, that's what's the party part about. You know?
Yeah. So where would you go to get some information to create this line? You're listening to what the guitar is doing. You're listening to what the drums are doing. You're listening to what the melody is. But then what else would you use to inform some of these bass lines?
Well, the bottom line is Brown actually gives you all the instruments. He give everybody their part. You know, you get a guitar, tell them how you want to play, you know, like the rhythm, and then you get a bass line, you know.
Okay, so he kind of told you how he wanted the line to go.
Give me the line. Damn it. You know, he gave me that line.
Okay.
Anybody, he gave me lines, you know, but just playing the lines, you know, like it still got to be a groove.
Yeah, absolutely.
We always screamed about the one, you know, one, give me the one. You know, only one. He's the only cat that I know, that I knew that do that.
Yeah. But then that was because of his dancing, right?
Obviously.
Yeah.
Always know when you hit him on that one, he ain't lost. He's right there.
Yeah.
That's a result, man. You know, like, it was just my style of playing, man. You know, and me and Cheese grooving together. Like, we made grooves out of whatever he gave us, man. You know, like, me and him had that vibe.
Yeah.
What I mean, to feed off each other, you know, so to speak. And Hot Pants was just such a, I don't know. I don't even know.
I have the whole personnel here for that record. That's James Brown, Bobby Bird, Herlin Cheese Martin, and Bobby Lee Coleman on guitar. You on bass, Fred Thomas. St. Clair, Pinckney on tenor. Jimmy Parker, who I'm assuming is Maceo, on alto.
Yeah, Jimmy Parker. That was the other member with my band in Brown.
Okay. Yeah. That was Maceo? Maceo was in your band?
That was Jimmy Parker.
Oh, Jimmy Parker. Okay. Not Maceo Parker. Fred Wesley on trombone. Darone Safford. Russell Crimes on trumpet. Johnny Griggs on congas. And Jabbo Starks on drums. Was
Was Starks the drummer in your band?
No.
With Cheese? Or was that a different drummer on the record?
Oh, what happened? Jabbo was with Brown for years, you know, way before I got there.
Okay.
Yes, quite a few years before I got there. Anyway, no, what happened? The funny thing about that, man, when Brown hired the whole band, the drummer didn't go because he had got inducted into the service. He was playing that night, but you could say that his Uncle Sam papers was in his pocket. He was going to the Army.
Oh, man.
Sam took him. We went with Brown. The other three of us went with Brown.
That was 66?
Yeah. Oh.
Did he make it back?
71 we went with Brown.
Okay.
So when Brown hired us, the drummer went into the service.
Yeah.
But he never played with Brown at all.
Did the drummer make it back from I'm assuming he went overseas to Vietnam, correct?
He made it back.
Good. So that was the first record you did with Brown. What was the next record you did with Brown? And what was touring like when you're used to, let's start there. What was touring like after you're touring this record? You're used to these small clubs, and now you're doing the James Brown Experience for 2 hours, and it's 2 hours of high energy all over the place, and he's, you know, he's who he is, and the, you know, huge stadiums, concerts. What kind of things were you playing? What was that touring like?
What can I tell you, man? It was just touring, you know, that doing something. And like, I was a funny cat, man. It's never like stuff like that. It's never excited me to the fact of it. Oh, I don't want to, you know. But the thing about it, I was just touring with Brown. And the most exciting part about touring was going to different places, you know, different cities.
The traveling, yeah.
You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I wasn't really overly excited. I never got excited by playing with Brown. As a matter of fact, out on the road and I come back off the road with Brown. That was people in the neighborhood. They said, "Man, why are you hanging with these cats over here? You know, you should be James Brown. You should be hanging over there. Why are you hanging with these cats like that? You should be hanging with that." I said, "Listen, that's me. You know, I'm just a hummer like that. You know, my friends, my peoples. I don't feel no different than I felt before around them. You know, I don't feel like I'm high and mighty or I'm playing with James Brown, this, that, and other. I never felt like that."
Yeah, know? That's great. That's great. I mean, there's so many other people I don't think are able to say that that's what's important to them. You know, I think it's very cool that you're still interested in staying grounded.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Keep my head on here. I don't want to get big headed. You know,
no, that's great, man. That's great. So you did the tours, and then what is the next record you do with James?
Well, the first dance came to JB's, man.
Okay.
The first song we did was "Pass the Peace."
Mm-hmm.
That's when the JB's came in. You know, we did about five albums with the JB's, and then they had Len Collin. One of the songs that was sampled that I played bass on was "You Better Think."
Yeah.
I recorded a couple of albums with her, and I recorded with Bobby Bird.
Okay.
I got a bunch of recordings, man. You know, I'm trying to get paid now. Absolutely, man, for sure.
Is that working out for you?
Man, you know, I didn't realize that how much my bass lines had been sampled, man.
Yeah.
You know, I had this guy about a year ago to do my website for me. And he went into all this, showed me all this stuff, man. He said, "Man, you got so many songs and lines from different tunes, samples, you know, hundreds of times, 50 times, da 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 da." And so that's the way to get paid for it. And then also, man, I got to get a lawyer for this. I just haven't ever taken the time to do it. You know, for all the music that I recorded, because all the stuff I recorded with Brown and JB, this whole production, hey, man, there's a lot of bass, you know, bass lines and stuff. So the thing is, I had to have a lawyer. Then I had to go in, and I didn't record all of the bass lines from all of the songs, you know, that was recorded, all of the album. But I say 85% of all of the album, I recorded all the bass.
Yeah.
But then I have to go through all these albums and pick out, you know, each song that I played on, you know, get the credentials right on it, and put all that together, you know, for the lawyers to pursue getting paid, you know. So it's a lot, man. It's a lot out there, you know, that I plan to get into to do. But I plan on, like, when I moved south, right, I figured I would have more time to, like, do that, yeah. You know. But then I had also set up a school to teach
okay.
school. Work here, you know, about the funk,
yeah,
you know, master class with, you know, a lot of people, some guys want to just learn, you know, what was my whole thing, you know, how I did this line and why I think of this line and what was the purpose, how did I play this line and make it feel like it feel, and etc. So,
the feel, man, the feel on all those records was so specific. And I was talking with a drummer, I don't know what it was, a couple weeks ago, I think. And we were talking about those grooves, you know, specifically from James Brown. And then if it was a really academic musician that goes and tries to play these grooves, you know, completely metronomically correct and like boom, 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 and mechanically and technically precise, it doesn't have the feel at all. There's this swagger to those grooves that you have to practice, like, that's to really nail some of those grooves, you know, like they were played, takes more time than I think. You can't just listen to it and be like, oh, you know, it's E flat to D flat, then back D flat or whatever it might be. Like, the feel of those things is very specific. It's very specific, and it's fantastic. I love that stuff.
Well, that's what always makes the difference, man. And like, I tell a lot of musicians, and I don't pray. I said, and one thing you always remember, you know, and it took me a long time, man, to get the band that I have now for the past 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Since Brown died, you know, when he died in 2006, so I had to go back and regroup.
Yeah. You know,
start back to playing, you know, like in the field again. And,
were you playing with him at the end there when he passed? Were you playing on some of his last performances? Were you back with him?
We was booked, man, for the whole holiday weekend. You know, we were supposed to be at B.B. King's, and we were supposed to be going to Canada, and we were supposed to play in Jersey, you know, for like Christmas Day and New Year's and New Year's Eve, and then after that, you know.
Yeah.
We had about 4 gigs to do, and, you know, we didn't do one yet. We were supposed to do one that Christmas night.
Yeah.
Christmas morning, you know, like at 3 o'clock in the morning, something like that, you know. But yeah, he was wide open, man. He was touring. He even slowed down a lot, you know, because he's that age, and, you know, he's kind of sickly too, a little bit, you know, different stuff going on with him, whatnot.
Sure.
You know, but, you know, like, me and him come kind of close, you know, like during that time.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was talking about, whatever you play, the problem I have with musicians, man, whatever I want you to play, you know, like, I say, what you're doing, you're playing fine, that is fine, but it's one little specific thing, but not like that, that can make the difference.
In yeah.
Just, you know, big old gap and nothing, just a little something, that's going to make the difference in the whole groove. You know, because you have drummers, man, that they want to play the one, like when we're doing Brown. So, as a matter of fact, the drummer that Porter went with us when Brown hired us went into the service, as Brown died, the guy was back here in New York. I said, listen, man, I'm going to get you to play drum. You know, we're going to go all the way back.
Okay. You know?
Okay. You to play drum. But you know what that guy told me, Ryan? After the first rehearsal, you come out to the second rehearsal. He said, man, I hear you always talking about playing the one, but I'm telling you now, I'm not going to play no one. All the time. I said, bye. Listen, you got to play the one on Brown stuff. Yeah. All music got a one.
Sure.
But Brown got to emphasize the one, like, pop,
Yeah, really lay into it.
Stop that one in there. And so you got, if you're going to do Brown Mills, it's fine. It's, well, we playing with some Pickett or this friend, you know, like them guys like that, OJs or somebody like that. You don't have to do that. You know, it's going to play Brown music, which I will be doing, you know, then you got to play that one, you know, and trying to get cats to just play a specific thing seemed like it's so difficult, man. Cats, they want to go back and then go to jamming it the way that they want to jam.
Yeah. And playing and keeping it simple for that long. Like some of those, you know, like the Big Payback is a song that comes to mind. Was that you on bass, the Big Payback?
Oh, guy named Charles Sorrell.
Okay. But grooves like that of James Brown, where you're just sitting on it forever and just holding it right there and keeping that feel so consistent, that's its own challenge. Like that's sometimes more difficult than playing a bunch of stuff that's fancy or impressive, you know, just holding it. And I talk about that quite a bit, actually. Like that's the consistency of just laying it down and holding it there and not moving.
Right word, brother.
It's
really, you never let up, man. You know, I mean, it's there. Every bar is there. And you got to keep that, you know.
Yeah.
Drop back. And I mean, like with Gabe Prayer playing guitar, you know, me and him met, you know. And he started playing. Yes, I had him just come around, man. We hang out and whatnot. And I, you know, I told him about, you know, about the rhythm. And he cares that shit now, though, man. You know, how to play that key rhythm, that straight rhythm, and how to lock it in.
Lock it,
you know, and whatnot. And told him, as a matter of fact, he was trying to do something here. And he sent me the, I think it was Soul Pop. And I did a bass line. So that's a bass line. I sent it to him. I said, I played the guitar with it, but he couldn't get the timing right.
Yeah.
Because I know what the problem is, you accent the one. I said, no, that's for the drummer to do. I mean, it's easy to miss and tap it.
Yeah.
You know, no, but you playing like you're playing the drum. On the one, you just play the tank,
Yeah.
You know, like you're rushing it. You're going to sound like you're rushing every time. Yeah, but anyway, a lot of stuff goes with that, man.
On episode 65 of the podcast, I spoke with Eric Rivas. And this one, my conversation with Eric Rivas was killing. Like, I sat with some of the things he talked about. They were just, I just sat with them for a while, which was the fascinating, because that's how I felt when I heard him play. Like, just I think it was a few nights before I'd heard him play at the Baked Potato, and that like I was just really wearing that music and how what he was doing impacted that music. And that was a heavy experience for me musically to check him out and be, you know, for anyone who's been to the Baked Potato, pretty small room. So to kind of be in a small club checking him out, you know, that was a powerful kind of thing, you know, for anybody who's listened to the episode. Like, I got lost driving home, ended up having to call the fire department, because I saw some dude get hit by a car. It was a crazy drive home from the Baked Potato that night. But the music was heavy, and hearing from Eric on the podcast equally was wonderful. And his perspective on things is killing. His perspective on it all is just really dialed in, and is really thought out and very deliberate. And I loved it. And it's something that has stuck with me since the conversation. Eric Rivas is a veteran jazz musician, spent a lot of time in New York playing, now lives out here in Los Angeles, has been with the Branford Marcellus Quartet for a few decades, and also has a series of records out himself. Absolutely check out Eric Rivas. His website is ericrivas.com. For more information on him and the talk with his music, his playing is comes from such a place, and he speaks about it. He speaks about it on episode 65 of the podcast. And here's a clip from the chat with Eric Rivas.
You know, I like what turns me on is playing bass.
Yeah.
And I know very few bass players who have been hired for their solo acumen. You know, It's like you're hired to make somebody else sound good. And within that, I mean, this whole story, I remember, you know, talking to cats in New York, and they were, you know, this whole notion of the bass being liberated. And it's like, liberated from what? Shit, we're the only ones doing it. We're the only ones playing what we play. You know, it's like all of this stuff. So I have no problem with, you know, facility as a concept. If your voice is like, but I think that if you're actualizing your voice through facility, that's one thing, you know, but if it is just, you know, like, wanton facility, and it's like, wow, he's moving fast. It's kind of like, you know, when you're 16 and you hear Stanley Clarke for the first time, it's like, God, this is the greatest thing in the world. Wow. And, you know, couldn't sing a solo for it. It'd be like, this shit is phenomenal. You know, it's like, yeah. When you get older, and it's like, it is still, it's not disparaging Stanley at all, but it's like, you know, it just becomes less than, it's like, wow, wait a minute, you know, but this dude doing this is really, I'm more prone to that kind of thing. But I mean, you know, like I said, there's so many great bass players, and there is a bass community, bass camaraderie, and you know, I love them all. You know, me like Ben Wolf talk all the time, and you know, it's like all this. There's just, man, there's all kinds of people that I dig.
Yeah. What was the phrase? Liberate the bass, free the bass. Yeah. What was this thing? This was going around New York. This is what dudes were talking about.
You know, the bass needs to be, you know, the notion of bass being liberated from its, I guess, essentially its function. You know, like, why can't we do this? Why can't we do this? You know, it's like, and it was kind of, you know, well, why do they get to take all the solos? Why do they, you know, so it was a kind of a school of some guys that were that. And I always had a disagreement with that.
You know? I do too. What kind of time frame are we looking at? Is this like kind of mid-90s when like...
Early to mid-90s.
Yeah, when Technique kind of really hit the scene. You know, I mean, you could just trace that back through records. And through every instrument, like it seems like that time period was a very technical.
Well, you know, I think what happened, and like you're saying, it did a disservice to all instruments, man, because there was like, if you check out like more traditional music, you check out, say, like Jelly Roll Morton or something like that. Everybody had a role in which they played. Mm-hmm. There was a certain functionality of their instrument. And within that space, they had all the latitude in the world. They could play, you know, I mean, they were soloing. It's like, it was really, you know, like, it's like free music. It's like everybody had their thing. But, you know, trumpet players sound like trumpet players.
Right.
Trombone sounded like trombone, clarinets. You know, they tended to like arpeggiate a lot. It was like all of these things going on. And then you got to around the 90s and you had all these saxophone players, you know, checking out piano players. And you had piano players checking out saxophone players and this and that. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the information, because information is information. That's fine. But I think that the downside of that is everybody started sounding alike.
Right.
It's like, shit, you know, you had tenor players who you didn't know if they were playing tenor or alto. You had like, you know, and it just, and now everybody pretty much plays the same vocabulary. You know, it's you know, the scale chord type, you know, everybody plays pretty much the same vocabulary. I'm generalizing, of course.
Sure. But,
Yeah, it's a disservice, man. I remember when tenor players were tenor players.
Yeah,
alto players. There's like a certain thing about it. And now it's kind of all this ish.
Another guest that was, one of these moments where like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm talking to this guy. Like, really? I'm on the phone with this guy. David Hood from the studio, you know, the house studio band down at Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Now I got hip to like the Muscle Shoals thing when that documentary came out. I'm a big documentary guy. The documentary Muscle Shoals came out in 2013. And so obviously like, oh, new music documentary, got to check this out. And I remember getting to gig like the next day, talking to the drummer, like, yo, dude, you checked out this documentary? Yeah, this thing's amazing. And he's like, yeah. Like, I really dug it. I'm like, dude, I did some of that stuff. Like, I wasn't even really hip to Muscle Shoals and that sound and what was going on. Like, in the back of my mind, I always just kind of chalked it up to like, it's probably cut in New York or Detroit. You know, I wasn't hip to it all yet. And so I really went down the rabbit hole on like the music that was recorded there at Muscle Shoals and really started investigating that. And now when I can hear the difference in the sound that everybody talked about and the sound that was impacted by the geography of being down in the South and by the swamp there and all that and how that impacted the music. And it's noticeable. It's different. And so doing this deep dive on the studio and the place in Alabama, Muscle Shoals, and all the music that was coming out of there, obviously, I learned of David Hood, who's the session bass player for the Swampers. The Swampers was the house band, the name of the house band at Muscle Shoals. And this is a big thanks to Dan Lakin, because David Hood also has an Inspired by Bass by D. Lakin Basses. After Dan sent me mine, we're talking about just the company and stuff. He's like, yeah, I'm gonna, you know, I did one for David Hood too. He's like, you want David on the podcast? I'm like, oh my gosh, dude, of course. Are you kidding me? Yeah. And so Dan Lakin lined this up. Thank you, Dan Lakin, for that. And this was an absolute, like, you know, I can't believe this is happening. David Hood is responsible for so much music. I would qualify him as kind of, you know, the Swampers and that studio and the people that were involved in making that music. All the cats that made up the Swampers, I would call them cultural icons. Like, he's responsible for so much. And this was a huge thing for me. And I know since, I believe I'm accurate in saying, since the interview, the drummer, the house band for the Swampers, the drummer, I'm blanking on his name right now, but has since passed, and that sucks. I remember in the interview, David talking about, telling me that he was not on great health at the time. And so since the interview, that has happened, and that sucks. Speaking with David was absolutely wonderful and still a big highlight for me as a person, you know, kind of a career highlight, a highlight, I think, for the podcast. And so I had to acknowledge David Hood on this episode. And here it is. Here's my talk with David Hood, bass player for the Swampers in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. My favorite thing about Muscle Shoals is how socially progressive it was for its time with integrated sessions in the South. And I think that's absolutely amazing. And that's one of my favorite things about that studio in history.
The South has gotten a really bad rap because of the racial problems, but I never witnessed any racial problems.
Sure. And it seemed like everybody there at the studio was in it for the music. And did that idea kind of permeate all of Muscle Shoals, the town itself?
Not necessarily, but it definitely did the music people.
Sure.
And this place gets pretty redneck sometimes.
Yeah.
But in the music, we knew that we had to be more, for one thing, me and my partners, loved rhythm and blues.
Right.
And that became almost second nature to us. And before we started recording, we played in bands that played that. Mm-hmm. When I was playing the fraternity parties and stuff, the music we played was The Temptations and Booker T and all that right. stuff. So we loved that. I got to work with Otis Redding.
Oh, wow.
With him being a producer.
Okay.
And he was great. He produced Arthur Conley and some other people, but just him telling me, well, play this or do that. I learned so much from him.
Yeah.
I still count him as one of my big influences. And he died so young. But, I worked with Duane Allman. Duane Allman was a genius.
Yeah.
He died when he was, 26 or 27?
Right.
He died too soon, but there's no telling what he would have done had he lived.
Sure. It's funny, man. I've throughout the world, these people with such a strong force of kind of spirit have passed on at a young age. And it's almost as if they were too much. You know,
yeah.
like this spirit and this energy that they had were almost too much, kind of couldn't be contained almost.
Right. I believe that.
And it seems to be the case with a lot of musicians that all passed. Was Duane, was he 27? Was he part of that 27 club?
I think 26 or 27.
He was
brilliant. He just, I mean, his playing, he was so good. And I mean, he worked with us in one of the early times when I was playing at Fame with the rhythm section, and he couldn't be held down. He didn't want to be a studio player. He didn't want to come in every day and do it and
have a job. Like you wanted to.
It was like what we were doing was like a regular job. He didn't want to do that.
Yeah. How did at what point did you ever feel frustrated with the studio thing and think it was too much of a regular job? And were you more interested in going out on the road more than you had been?
No. I mean, maybe every now and then I'd like to have gone on the road, but I like the studio. To this day, I'd rather do that than play live.
Okay. What is it about the studio that appeals to you the most?
I like being able to, different stuff every day, for one thing. And I like to be able to try to make it sound like it's supposed to sound. I like that part of it.
The creative process of putting it together.
I mean, we learned the song from never have heard the song to recording it in a master quality. It's about an hour. I mean, we can learn stuff really quickly with our chord charts. We can put it together quickly.
Yeah.
But then once I've done it, I'm ready to move on to the next thing.
Yeah, right. You did it. Next. Yeah. All right, folks. Thank you all for listening and supporting the Bass Shed podcast over the years. It's been wonderful. It's been wonderful to meet all the people that I've gotten a chance to meet and talk with. You know, I remember on that episode with David Hood. I think it was after we kind of got off the interview portion of it. We were talking about Jerry Germont, and he just gives me Jerry Germont's number, and then I'm texting Jerry Germont. Like, again, surreal. Like, I'm texting Jerry Germont. That's amazing. And Jerry and I have actually been kind of messaging back and forth since this happened, since I got his number and we started a dialogue about getting him on, and we're still sorting that out. Yeah, I would love to have Jerry Germont on. Obviously, the idea of interviewing another legend, you know, and just from an interview standpoint, like Jerry Germont interviewed Jocko on the Jocko video, in addition to having an incredible career that had nothing to do with Jocko Pastorius. but there's a lot of connections there for me as being someone who would interview him, in addition to all the amazing work Jerry Germont has done. But all these things that have popped up over the years because of the podcast, and it's been absolutely wonderful, and I can't thank you all enough for listening and continuing to engage in it. This is going to be the last podcast of 2022. I'm going to take a couple weeks off for the holidays. I'm doing some traveling for the holidays.
Christopher over there is doing some traveling for the holidays, so we're just gonna take a breather and kind of prep for 2023. So again, thank you all so much for listening. It's been a really fun ride, and I'm looking forward to the next 100 episodes. Thanks, folks, and I will catch you on the next one in a minute.